This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, a new plan to fix flammable cladding on our buildings. Looking for answers about why an aged care home shut suddenly last week. And why military sexual assault rates remain essentially unchanged. Welcome to the program. The federal government is refusing to contribute money to a $600 million cladding rectification fund announced by the Victorian government today, as the states and territories appear set to clash over what to do about the wobbling building industry. The Premier, Daniel Andrews, says his state is leading the world when it comes to identifying buildings at risk of fire, and he's urging other states and the Commonwealth to get behind a national strategy to tackle the problem of dangerous cladding. But the Federal Treasurer is adamant building safety is a state issue. From Melbourne, Samantha Donovan reports.
For residents of buildings at risk of fire because of dodgy cladding, today's announcement is a step in the right direction. Marcus Veerman's apartment in Melbourne has been identified as at extreme risk.
Announcements are one thing. For me, it's just about really seeing action. Our body corporates need solid support to make this change happen quickly so that we can move away from being in basically a building covered in petrol to something that we're safe to live in. It should just never have happened.
The Victorian government says the program it's announced today is a world first. It includes a $600 million fund to fix buildings at risk of fire. The Premier, Daniel Andrews.
We've got the most comprehensive audit of buildings anywhere in the world. We know and understand the nature of the problem. We are taking the action required to make these buildings safe in the interests of residents, in the interests of neighbours, and in the interests of first responders who, without this action, I fear, will be called to potentially very, very nasty fires.
Mr Andrews is calling on the federal government to cover half the fund, $300 million. He argues dangerous cladding is a national issue and a true national partnership is needed.
There are $300 million that will be provided by the Victorian government. There is then a request for the Commonwealth, as recommended by the cladding task force, for a proper partnership, a partnership that's beyond politics, a partnership that involves all parties and all governments. This is a national issue. A number of other states who face similar challenges to us have been waiting to see what Victoria does. And to that end, I've written to the Prime Minister today, seeking a partnership and asking that this matter be put on the COAG agenda for the next meeting in August.
But the Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, is ruling out a Commonwealth contribution to Victoria's cladding rectification fund.
Well, we're not picking up the bill for what is a state responsibility. The problems in relation to cladding have been a product of a failure of compliance and enforcement at a state level. I mean, it's a fundamental business of state governments to ensure the safety of their buildings, and the Australian people would expect that being a state responsibility, it's carried out. What we have offered to do at the federal level is to set up a task force to see through the recommendations from that report that has been discussed by building industry ministers. That offer is on the table. It was offered in February and it will be offered again when the ministers next meet.
Aside from the funding contribution, Victoria argues a national response is needed because the Commonwealth is responsible for the quality of imported products, can help stabilise the insurance industry, and because of the national corporations laws. Daniel Andrews.
So many of these apartment buildings have been built by Phoenix companies, and almost as the last nail is driven, the company folds up and there's no one to go after. We think that's something that should be on the national agenda as well. Those who've done the wrong thing should not only be punished, but every avenue should be explored to recoup as much money as possible through them and their insurers to offset the cost to taxpayers to get this job done.
The Insurance Council of Australia also believes a national approach is needed. Its spokesman is Campbell Fuller.
The Victorian government's response is quite positive in many respects. It really does highlight the need for urgent, nationally coordinated action on the issues of flammable cladding and the use of non-conforming building products.
But the Insurance Council believes it's the builders, not governments, who should be footing the rectification bill. Campbell Fuller.
The industry's view is that that any compensation and rectification should be paid by the sector responsible. We don't believe that taxpayers should be on the line for those rectification issues and those compensation issues. But again, this is a matter for the Victorian government and the federal government and the other state and territory governments to thrash out on Thursday.
The Victorian Cladding Task Force has made 35 recommendations to the state government. Two of them are being adopted immediately, the fund and the setting up of an agency to be known as Cladding Safety Victoria. The remaining 33 recommendations are being considered.
Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, the troubles in the building industry will dominate a building ministers' forum on Thursday, convened by the Federal Industry Minister Karen Andrews, who shares Josh Frydenberg's view that the sector's crisis is down to the states failing to ensure compliance under the National Construction Code. Confidence in the building industry is being hit not only by the flammable cladding issue, but by wider building quality questions, including the three Sydney buildings that were evacuated because of cracks. All of that has also spooked the insurance industry, which has pushed up its costs and squeezed access to insurance for certifiers and surveyors. Well, Craig Laundy was the Federal Industry Minister prior to his departure from politics at the May election. He had work underway that he says could still help address key issues. But I asked him first if the federal government should contribute, as Victoria has asked.
Short answer, no. There is an issue of federalism here, absolutely, which the Victorian Premier has raised. But the federal government and the state government have control of what's called the National Construction Code, but the actual enforcement and policing of it is absolutely solely the domain of the states and territories. And the problem that you've got Australia-wide at the moment in the move to private certification, as opposed to prior to that, where councils had extensive records of, you know, what was where and certification documentation, there is absolutely a lack of documented evidence that the certifiers have been, doing the work, and no one can turn around and put their hands on something to verify what is actually on these buildings.
But what about the fact that this is now a national crisis? I mean, as well as the cladding issue, the insurance flow-ons from that and the cracked buildings, the three in Sydney, for example, that have also shaken confidence in the industry. I mean, there's a national dimension to this. Is there not a role for the Commonwealth beyond getting the ministers together?
Look, there are different parts that the Commonwealth can play working with the states, and you've seen that. So in my 4 years as the minister responsible, working with state colleagues, we have changed the National Construction Code so that a new fire testing regime, again, one I would argue is world's best, has been implemented that these panels must pass. So there has and will continue to be things that the state and federal ministers responsible through the COAG mechanism that is the Building Ministers Forum will continue to do. However, it is again very clear that the consent, the enforcement, this all lies with our state and territory counterparts. There is very clear demarcation lines here.
So what were you proposing as minister to try to fix that?
I was proposing a pilot, and Victor Dominello, the minister at the time, in New South Wales, because I couldn't get all eight state and territory leaders ministers to agree with me. But New South Wales has the Data Analytics Centre, which is the engine room behind data analysis in New South Wales, most notably Service New South Wales. There are only eight or nine companies that distribute this cladding product. Now, their point of sale systems have in them where these orders are taken from and delivered to. They've got extensive records of where they've supplied this cladding over the last 15 or 16 years. Now, they agreed to a pilot in March last year to basically getting Border Force, the point of sale companies and the Data Analytics Centre in New South Wales to come up with a way of potentially solving this problem. We should have a portal where certifiers can deposit their documentation so that it is readily accessible should it need to be checked for compliance purposes by a regulator at any point in the future.
Is that process still ongoing since you left as a minister and a federal member?
I don't know. However, I have reached out to the Premier's office here in New South Wales. My fear is that it's fallen between the cracks when I really do think, as did my ministerial counterparts in New South Wales at the time, think it's a very practical way of remedying the issue, not only moving forward, but potentially with the help of the suppliers, working retrospectively as well.
What about the wider issue of, you know, cracked buildings and the insurance industry? Do you see a way through that?
I think the insurance problem, again, the documentation and the authentication of the certification through access to the documentation by the insurance company solves what has basically become, through private certification over the last 15 years, a void of information.
Craig Launday, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Linda.
Craig Launday was the Federal Industry Minister until the last election, now back in private life. Well, the operator at the centre of a nursing home disaster on the Gold Coast, where more than 70 elderly patients were moved out in the middle of the night, says it would like recent events to be scrutinised by the Royal Commission into aged care. The Earl Haven Retirement Village was stripped of food, medicines and its patients, and the centre's operator, Help Street, says it hadn't been paid properly by People Care, the facility's owner. Well, today, the facility's owner met residents, families and workers for the first time since the shutdown. Bronwyn Herbert reports.
Family representatives met the owner of the Earl Haven Retirement Village for the first time since the home's shock evacuation last Thursday. Bernadette O'Connor from the Queensland Nurses and Midwives Union attended the closed meeting and says residents were in tears.
The distress and the uncertainty, I think that's the two words that sum it up best. And then sort of the defensiveness, you know, feeling that they can't trust anyone else. I found it quite confronting.
Annette Bartels, whose father was moved from the facility, says it's an uncertain time.
My father is a little confused. It's an unprecedented event and I think what they said is correct. They can't give assurances.
The future is unclear with an ongoing financial dispute between the owner, People Care, and the subcontractor who ran the facility, Help Street. The operator is also in the firing line for taking payments just one day before the residents were kicked out. Melva Morrison says her 97-year-old husband George was asleep in his bed at the facility when the ambulance and police arrived.
Well, it was a hell of a shock. That Help Street mob, jeez, couldn't believe what they did, you know, and what they did the day before about taking the fee out of the banks. The day before on the Thursday, and Friday it was closed.
Did that happen to you?
Yes. It happened to all of us, every one of us.
Today, Chris Bunker, Help Street's chief executive, spoke to reporters for the first time, but he didn't take questions.
I'm devastated. This situation is unprecedented and very complicated. In 7 years since I founded Help Street, I've never experienced anything like what I saw last week. It was heartbreaking. We've been informed today by our banking partner just now that all of the monies are in the process of being refunded to residents.
The Gold Coast facility is the only place where Help Street provides aged care services. The company also moved to address concerns over missing funds, medication and medical records that had allegedly been removed from the nursing home that day.
Like all of you, I have serious questions over what happened to residents' medication. We know People Care have security cameras in Earl Haven, and we call on People Care to release the video footage and it will show exactly what happened. We're doing everything we can to assist the federal department with their inquiry and fully support a police investigation. We back union calls for federal government to scrutinise the aged care industry as part of its Royal Commission.
A representative from People Care, the owner of the facility, was unavailable to speak with PM. Union representative Bernadette O'Connor says there are still many unanswered questions.
The reality is they saw, as one gentleman said, my best mates, I saw them being, you know, carted away. And, you know, they have it as a long-term plan that this will be when they can't care for themselves.
Police, as well as state and federal authorities, are investigating exactly what occurred.
Bronwyn Herbert with that report. You are listening to PM. We're on the radio. We are also on the ABC Listen app, and you can subscribe to the PM podcast as well. If you haven't already, please do so. I'm Linda Mottram. Switching allegiances ahead, a former Nauruan weightlifter is now hurling 137 kilograms above her head for Australia at the Pacific Games in Samoa.
I knew that my ex-teammates, Nauru, some of them be disappointed. Some of them won't talk to me just because I'm Australian now. At the end of the day, I chose to switch.
Rates of sexual misconduct and assault in the Australian Defence Force remain essentially unchanged, despite years of scandals and reports and efforts to improve reporting and accountability, researchers say. And they're calling on the ADF to release more data to help make more progress. The ADF's Skype and Jedi Council sex scandals, among others, sparked multiple inquiries and pledges of zero tolerance. New initiatives were accompanied by measures to address gender inequity as well, moves echoed in militaries in other parts of the Western world. So how effective has it all been? A panel in Sydney this week will ask, when will the military have its Me Too moment? It's convened by Megan McKenzie, who's Professor of Gender and War at the University of Sydney, and retired US Army Colonel Dr. Ellen Haring, who was part of a major legal case against the US military policy on excluding women from combat roles. She has also testified to the US Congress about military sexual violence. Both women joined me in the PM studio. Professor Megan McKenzie, if I can begin with you, hasn't the Australian military had its Me Too moment after the scandals of recent years and changes implemented by the military after the Broderick Report?
Well, I think we thought that we had the Me Too moment in the military, not just with the Skype scandal, but also the Jedi Council, which followed soon after, and then the speech by David Morrison that went viral around the world. However, data shows that nothing has changed. In fact, incidents of military sexual assault have remained the same, and that there isn't a lot of internal change, the kind of change that we would want.
But still, the ADF, for example, implemented the Sexual Misconduct Prevention and Response Office. It says that is about providing a better mechanism for reporting and providing support. Has that not been effective?
So I think it's been effective in the sense that there's more resources for victims, which is always a wonderful thing to see. We've seen their number of clients go up annually, which is great for in the sense of those victims having a resource. It's not great as an indicator of the problem. It's not getting better from all indications, even from the limited available data that we have. So we have a sense of the problem. We still actually need better data.
Ellen Haring, you know the US experience mm-hmm. particularly well. Does it echo the Australian experience?
Actually, it's almost identical, except that we do have better data. That's one of the requirements that Congress has leveled against our military. And so we've been collecting data for almost 10 years now. And unfortunately, what the data is showing is actually the problem is getting worse, not better. And we can't, you know, some people have said, well, the reporting is going up because women and men who are sexually assaulted have greater confidence in the system. But we don't believe, those of us that care for and assist assault victims don't believe that's the case. We think that reporting might be going up because of the Me Too movement. And that, in fact, nothing has really changed except that the problem could potentially be getting worse.
You also worked on a major US legal case to overturn longstanding combat exclusion policies that kept women from combat roles in the US military. When those new doors open for women, when they're given access to things that they couldn't have before in the military, does that help to change the culture around sexual misconduct?
Well, that was our goal and still is our goal, is that women need to be seen as equals. And as soon as they're seen as equal, they'll be treated more equally. But we've just now opened those doors. Just like in Australia, it hasn't been very long. And the first women who are integrating are really fighting an uphill battle right now. So no, things are not getting better yet, but we hope that eventually the culture will change and you will see a change in the way women are treated.
Megan McKenzie, you say that there is still an excuse made for bad behaviour. Boys will be boys. That mentality persists, you say. But we have heard from the most senior levels of the Australian military, and I think we've heard in the US as well, that there is now a climate of zero tolerance. So how do you square that?
Well, the truth is we've had a zero tolerance statement from military leaders on average once every 4 or 5 years for the last 2 decades. So for me, the zero tolerance statement is empty. We don't have zero tolerance. And I think it would be interesting to think about what would it mean if we had zero tolerance. Would we kick out service members who are accused of assault or charged with assault? How would we deal with the problem if we really had zero tolerance? And I think it would be much different. And despite that declaration of zero tolerance, we still have, you know, narratives that, well, when you have young men and women together in close confines and adrenaline's running high, these are the kinds of things that happen, or these are the kinds of things that happen when young men get together and drink. Those still exist. And quite frankly, the public accepts them.
Ellen, again, is it similar in the United States?
It's absolutely similar. And it's funny to me to hear the United States try to exceptionalize our military and say, well, we can't be compared to, say, Australia or another country's military because we're unique, we're so much bigger. And in reality, it's just happening at a smaller level in other countries, but almost identical in terms of the narrative that surrounds it. And that's one of the things that Dr. McKenzie is working on with her lab, is analyzing these narratives across multiple countries.
Mm. And I'm curious to hear from both of you, because I know there's a lot of critiquing around what happens, what is the circumstance for women when they do try to have a career in the military. Megan McKenzie, what is that experience like? I mean, is getting in enough, or is that recognition enough, or is there support enough? I mean, what's it like for them?
Well, I think actually the experience of women in the military is applicable to those of us outside the military in male-dominated spaces, in the sense that we've known, feminists have said for a long time, it's not enough to add women in STIR or just open the doors. And in fact, when we integrate women into those kind of workplaces without cultural change, they face an uphill battle, they face sexism, they're pushed out. And they, as a result, the emotional, the trauma for some women, particularly in the military, is massive. So we're asking a lot of women to sort of take on the burden of integration if there's no institutional change that comes with it.
Sort of letting the institutions off the hook.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Ellen, what's the answer to that, do you think? I mean, we do need to add more women and we do need to stir, but what do we do to change the institution itself?
So the U.S. has done a number of institutional changes, but they've been largely in response to assaults that have already happened, supporting victims and prosecuting perpetrators. What they have never done, we still haven't done, is look closely at our culture and figure out what in the world is wrong with military culture that allows or causes this level of sexual violence against women and men. So I don't want to... It is predominantly against women, but because of the large numbers of men, much more larger, the actual gross numbers of men who are sexually assaulted is as high as women. Because of the women are only about less than 20% of the military in the U.S., which is actually higher than the Australian Defense Force. So the numbers are high, and we have not tackled the culture. And I think the culture begins at that entry-level training when soldiers go through boot camp. And we have this kind of iconic notion of what boot camp looks like. And really, it's this hazing and harassment
quite
and
violent,
abuse.
Isn't it? Mm.
It's very violent, and it's very sexist. It's often laden with anti-women and anti-homosexual language and treatment and behavior. And that's like the very beginning training or indoctrination that soldiers get when they join, soldiers or sailors. And certainly Marines get when they join the military. And so nobody has gone after that kind of iconic boot camp to say, this might be the place we need to start looking. This might be what we have to change.
And Megan, in Australia as well, do you see the same need to change at that level?
Yes, I do. And I also think for Australia, I think our biggest problem is data, quite frankly. I think we need more information about what is actually happening. We need some transparency around it, not only the incidents it reports, but also the anonymous surveys that happen and we know happen with the ADF. But they're very difficult to access. And it's important so that we can kind of keep track of the scope of the problem. And for me, it's not just the data. I think in some ways, as a scholar, I think those focused on feminist issues have left the military alone. I think we focused on Me Too in various different institutions and sexual assault in different institutions and not tackled the military, either because we see them as exceptional or I'm not sure why that is, but I think it's a major global problem. It's not just an ADF problem. It's not just a US problem. It's actually a global problem. And I think we need to treat it that way.
Megan McKenzie, Ellen Haring, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor of Gender and War at the University of Sydney, Megan McKenzie, and retired US Army Colonel, Dr. Ellen Haring, who is also CEO of Service Women's Action Network. Well, Australia has gained its newest weightlifting star at Nauru's expense. Charisma Omoi Tarrant has just won a bronze medal in the super heavyweight division at the Pacific Games in Samoa. The 20-year-old had to wrestle with her Nauruan heritage and a family tragedy before she decided to don the green and gold. Anthony Stewart from Radio Australia's Pacific Beat reports from Apia.
As she prepares to lift 137 kilograms above her head, Charisma Omoi Tarrant lets out a roar. With the lift, she becomes one of Australia's strongest women and in the process wins a weightlifting bronze medal at the Pacific Games in Apia, Samoa.
Bronze medal representing Australia, Charisma Omoi Tarrant.
It's an emotional moment for the young athlete who's just switched allegiances from Nauru to Australia.
To be honest, I was just freaking out in there, but I was just putting up a brave face.
Omoi Tarrant has laboured with the decision for months. She won Nauru's only medal at the 2018 Gold Coast Commonwealth Games, a silver in the women's super heavyweight division.
I knew that my team, ex-teammates, Nauru, I knew they would be disappointed. Some of them won't talk to me just because I'm Australian now. At the end of the day, I chose to switch because I've always been thinking about switching as well ever after the Commonwealth Games last year.
But the 20-year-old is also an Australian. She was raised by her grandparents in Brisbane after the death of her mother in 2009.
My mum passed away she was having kidney problems. She's always been having it ever since she was a kid as well. She went to Fiji to, you know, get a surgery to get it removed. And so she was waiting for a kidney transplant, but unfortunately, with money problems back in Nauru at that time, my mom had to be sent back and with just one kidney, and there's nothing she could have done. And then 5 months after, during those five months, she was feeling ill, and then after that, she passed away.
What brought you to Australia?
My grandparents took care of me and my two younger siblings, and it took them 3 years, and in 2012, they finally took us to Australia, and it took us a while to become a citizen, but yeah, ever since my mom passed away, my grandparents have, made a promise to my mom that they'll look after the three of us and, have a better life and education in Australia.
Charisma Omoi Tarrant's addition to the Australian squad is a boon for weightlifting. Robert Mitchell is the head coach.
You know, high performance sport is about winning. Sad to say, and some people would say it's sad to say, but that's what it is. If you don't win, you don't get funding, you don't get government support, so you don't get public support. So it's about winning.
So she won a bronze today, a pretty strong performance in one of the most competitive events at this weightlifting tournament.
Absolutely, and you've got to remember she's still a junior weightlifter, so, she's got a lot of years ahead of her. She's green in the sport compared to some of the other people she was competing against.
Now the medal-winning weightlifter is taking her passion for the sport to another Pacific island, New Caledonia, and the Oceania Weightlifting Institute.
I'm away from home and I'm training full-on at the institute, training every day, and I should be at home helping them and, working, helping them with everything, but here I am following my dreams, doing what I love the most.
Australia's newest weightlifting star, Charisma Omoi Tarrant. Anthony Stewart reporting from the Pacific Games in Samoa. I'm Linda Mottram and that's PM. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Do not forget to subscribe and leave us a review while you're there. See you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.